So, Shane, you spent a decade of your life and $2 million of your own money investigating J.D. Salinger's life. What is it about Salinger that absorbed you so deeply?
Well, when I was a kid, J.D. Salinger was a very big deal in my house. My mom always talked about Salinger. She really loved Salinger. And she turned me on to all of his work, not just The Catcher in the Rye, when I was very, very young. So I was reading stories that I don't know if I should have been reading or not, but at about 10 or 11 or 12 years old. And I read everything that I could get my hands on. And, you know, this was before Amazon and Google and everything. I read the published work and the unpublished work, and when I was done, I remember asking my mom, okay, you know, what else? What, you know, where do I get the next J.D. Salinger book? And she said, well, there is no more work. I said, what do you mean? Did he die? And she said, no, he didn't die, but he stopped publishing, and he made this personal decision to stop publishing and to kind of disappear into the woods of New Hampshire, which was like the greatest thing you could tell a 12 or 13-year-old boy, because he became, you know, Salinger became like the literary Bigfoot to me.
And mythic figure who lost American
novelist.
He really
was. Yeah, he really was. I remember my mom telling me that they wanted him to be on the cover of Time magazine, and they said, you know, we just need to send a photographer up to take your picture, and he said, no, thank you, and hung up the phone. And so they had to draw him on September 15th, 1961, when he was on the cover of Time. And, you know, the previous week, Nikita Khrushchev was on the cover. Mm-hmm. I mean, Salinger was an icon, and he was famous for not being famous.
So, Shane, are you saying—
That just fascinated me.
Are you saying you've been obsessed with J.D. Salinger since you were about 12?
I don't know if obsessed is the right word. I certainly was fascinated with him. I mean, I have a, you know, 15,000 book library, and I care deeply about books, and I love Salinger very much. And but there was something different about Salinger that was different than any other author that I've ever encountered, where side by side with the work is this myth and mystique and mystery, and I spent a decade of my life trying to unravel that mystery and tell the story of his life. And people just have no idea about Salinger's life. They know the work, but they don't know his life. And they don't know that he landed on D-Day. They don't know that he was carrying the first six chapters of The Catcher in the Rye with him when other guys were carrying photos of their girlfriend. You know, they don't know that he lost the love of his life to Charlie Chaplin. Mm-hmm. There's all these things about his life that I was fascinated by. And I wanted to interview people before they were gone. And many of the people we interviewed over a decade are now gone. And that story would have been gone with them. So,
well, so Salinger has been written about before. And there have been biographies. There have been people who knew him, have editors, former lovers, children have written articles and memoirs. What do you think are the most important things that you've added to his story or changed?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, the difference between our book and those books were largely that in some of those cases, several of those cases, particularly recent cases, they wrote a whole book without ever speaking to one person who actually knew J.D. Salinger. They were sort of companion books or sort of compilation books of what was in the public record. I think what we did that was very different is we spent, you know, years and years convincing people to tell their stories for the first time. And we interviewed people who had held on to their stories entirely, whose name didn't even appear in the public record associated with Salinger for 60 years. So you have someone like Jean Miller, who met Salinger when she was 14 years old in 1949, and really dated him between, you know, the ages of 14 and 19. It wasn't sexual until she was of age, but they had a romantic relationship from 14 to 19.
And he was how old?
He was 30 when he met her, and 35 when they split up. But he, that relationship had never been told anywhere. I mean, it wasn't even known to Salinger's family. She had Jean, who's a wonderful lady. She had just kept these secret for six decades. She had also kept, she had originally had over 100 letters from Salinger, but she had kept about 50 of the letters, and had never shown them to anyone.
Oh, so you found 50 unpublished, undiscovered Salinger letters.
Yeah, I mean, we ended up, you know, probably assembling the largest collection of Salinger letters anywhere in the world. Probably have, I probably have, you know, I don't know, maybe 300 or something. But what's extraordinary is that he had this extraordinary relationship with this young girl. And it was interesting time, 49 to 54, because it was prior to the publication of The Catcher in the Rye and after it, prior to moving to Cornish, New Hampshire, and after it. And so you get this incredible vantage point of this soldier back from World War II with post-traumatic stress syndrome trying to connect with this 14-year-old girl, and she becomes the inspiration for Esme, and he ends up telling her that he could have never written Esme without her.
Esme and, for Love and Squalor, his famous one yes. of his famous short stories. Yeah.
Yes, and so that was a story that had to be told. I mean, people had heard about Joyce Maynard's story for so long, but the Maynard relationship lasted 9 months, and the Miller 5 years, and so there was just a privileged point of view she had of his life, his mm-hmm. beliefs, his immersion into the Vedanta religion, and so convincing her to speak took a great deal of time and care. Sitting on camera with her, sitting behind the camera when we were filming her, was an extraordinary experience because she was speaking about this man shortly after his death. She had made a vow to herself that she would never speak about Salinger while he was alive. So the interview became not only incredibly revealing and an enormously important part of the film and book, but also very cathartic for her to finally tell of her feelings. Mm. And then we had the same situation with the Fitzgerald family. Paul Fitzgerald was a serviceman who had served in the counterintelligence corps with Salinger in 1944.
I'm going to interrupt you there because I actually want to tell the whole World War II story. So,
sure.
Yeah. So, one of the things that you discovered that you write about a lot is how important Salinger's experiences in World War II were to him. You came to see it as really central to his writing and much of the rest of his life. What exactly did he do in World War II?
Well, I mean, let's just start with what he saw. This was a kid who grew up at 1133 Park Avenue. He had never suffered a day in his life. He was a privileged, very wealthy kid. He went to war thinking that it was going to be this romantic experience, like a Jack London novel. And what he found instead was really the worst horrors of World War II. J.D. Salinger's first day of combat was D-Day. He ended up participating in one form or another in D-Day, the Battle of San Lo, the Battle of the Hurricane Forest, Battle of the Bulge.
Did he actually see much action?
Yes. At different times he did see action. At different times he was under fire. He was a counterintelligence agent, not an infantryman. So he wasn't on the front lines every day, but he definitely saw combat. He definitely was under fire.
And he was also one of the first Americans to see some of the German concentration camps, am I right?
He walked in among the first soldiers to walk into a subcamp of Dachau called Kaufering. And in the film, in the book, we show for the first time ever what he actually saw. And that experience was so traumatic. The quote that he told his daughter and also Gene Miller and others was that you never get the smell of burning flesh out of your nostrils, no matter how long you live. And that was so traumatic that he checked himself into a mental institution immediately after the war.
How long did he stay?
He stayed for about 6 months. And what's amazing is in the middle of all of this, he was writing and publishing throughout the war in Collier's and the Saturday Evening Post. And that was kind of an incredible thing to see. Not that just somebody who was, jotting down some things in a journal, but he was actually writing and seeing his stories published. And there's a very famous story we have in the film and the book of in 1944, after the liberation of Paris, Salinger wanting to meet Ernest Hemingway, who was staying at the Ritz and assigned to Salinger's 4th Division, and Salinger pushing through a crowd to get to Hemingway and hand him his Collier story, and they become close friends. Salinger, if you can believe this, J.D. Salinger and Ernest Hemingway.
And didn't you say that Salinger actually went to battle with some of the chapters of The Catcher in the Rye with him?
They never left his side. I mean, when he landed on D-Day, he landed with the first six chapters of The Catcher in the Rye. And we know that from a letter that he wrote to Whit Burnett, his teacher at Columbia. And those pages saw all of the battles that I named and walked into that concentration camp at the end of the war.
So what's interesting is that for all that his war experiences really marked him, we don't think of him as a war writer. I mean, I can't remember in any of the stories or in Catcher in the Rye, I don't think any of them are set in battlefields or wartime experiences.
Well, they're set with wartime experiences, but they're not set on the battlefield. He only really wrote of actual combat one time, which was in an unpublished story called The Magic Foxhole that we excerpt in the book. But World War II is really the ghost in the machine of all those stories. They are the answers to issues of In Perfect Day for Banana Fish and Esme, and certainly the nine stories, which begin and end with echoes of World War II.
Wait, what do you mean? Why do you think the war is the ghost in the machine in a lot of his writing?
Well, I mean, the characters are soldiers in several of the key stories. Some of those soldiers have the same dog tag numbers that Salinger had. Issues of depression and suicide that permeate some of those stories are rooted in the fact that J.D. Salinger was suffering from depression and post-traumatic stress syndrome. In The Catcher in the Rye, he, you know, talks very much about the war and says if there's another war, he wants to get on the bomb and ride it all the way down himself, climb on top of it and ride it all the way down himself, which, of course, Stanley Kubrick right. took quite literally for Dr. Strangelove. And if it wasn't for World War II, we would have never heard the name J.D. Salinger. I mean, before World War II, J.D. Salinger was a serviceable short story writer. In fact, he never allowed those early pre-war stories to ever be published in book form because he called them the gaucheries of his youth. It's only after the war, after the mental institution, after all of the horrors that he saw, that he becomes J.D. Salinger and has that extraordinary voice. And that's when we get Banana Fish and Esme and Catcher and the Nine Stories. And,
but that's an extraordinary thing to say, that if it hadn't been for World War II, we would never have heard of J.D. Salinger. I mean, maybe he would have been a great writer and he wrote all those things despite the war.
Well, I don't think so, and I don't think he thought so. I mean, he never allowed that work to be bound in book form. He never allowed those early stories to be part of the Nine Stories. He told the New York Times that they were the gaucheries of his youth and actually fought to keep them from being published in 1974. He recognized that he needed the experience of war to make him a better writer. He very famously, I believe it was told Esquire that he was desperately trying to get rid of the neckties that were in his drawer, meaning his Park Avenue privileged lifestyle. But he never recovered from two things. One that happened in 1943, which was losing Una O'Neill, the daughter of Eugene O'Neill.
This was the first woman he fell in love with?
First woman that he fell in love with, and the love of his life and the shaping influence of his life in terms of young women. In 1943, lost her to Charlie Chaplin, who at the time was the most famous man in the world, and he found out about it when he was overseas training for what would become his service in World War II. And then the second thing, as he himself said, you never get the smell. I mean, that line, which he echoed for decades to various people that we interviewed, it kept coming up, are really the two shaping influences of his life. I mean, the World War II was the transformative trauma of his life. The only true relationships that he maintained throughout his life. People would come in and be in for a few years and then be dismissed, but the only true friendships that lasted were the three men that he served in World War II with, who we revealed two of the three for the first time, and they called themselves the Four Musketeers. And Salinger really, after World War II, came to see the world as divided between civilians and veterans. And he held a very special place in his heart for anybody who had seen the horrors of war.
There's another weird story that comes out of his time during World War II. It's the story of his first wife. This was a woman he met during the war. And later you suggest that she might have been a Gestapo informant?
After the mental institution, J.D. Salinger did something that I could, no one else would really do. I mean, after everything that he had seen and having checked himself into a mental institution, most people would have gone home. And what he did, and this is when I found this out, this is when I really said I have to make this film. What Salinger did that was so unique is he signed back up for more. He signed up a post-war contract to be part of the denazification of Germany. And in the process of really trying to hunt the people down that did these horrible things, he met and married a German woman named Sylvia Welter and brought her home legally to his parents' Jewish Park Avenue apartment with a big German dog and tried to integrate the two worlds that he had seen, the world that existed before the war and the world that existed for him now.
That marriage lasted, a year less?
It was a very short marriage, and in the process of spending time with her in New York, he found out that she had actually been an agent for the Gestapo. And we interviewed, several people who confirmed this on the record, including Leela Hadley, a very close friend of his, and someone who actually dated him. And immediately upon finding this out, he filed for an annulment and really sent her back to Germany. The public record for 50 years has been that they filed for divorce and she went back, but it's not true at all. We actually recovered and found and published the annulment papers, which we found in Germany, in German, and had to translate. And he would not have anything to do with her ever again. And in fact, around his house, called her Saliva instead of Sylvia. And
that's just an extraordinary story, though. I mean, for a man who was so marked by his experience in World War II and who had helped liberate a concentration camp to then, unbeknownst to himself, wind up marrying a Gestapo informant, it must have really scarred his relationships with women for a long time.
It did, and it really shows you how much he was struggling with what he had seen in World War II. It suggests that he was able to sympathize both with victim and perpetrator for some time and then was unable to process that she had been part of these horrible things that had happened in some way. And, as you know from that war, you didn't directly have to be there to participate. And what he found as a person who had been raised Jewish in many ways was extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And he just couldn't have anything to do with her ever again. And in fact, she sent a letter many years later to him, and he never even opened it. When he was done with a person, he was done, and he was certainly done with Sylvia Welter. When she died, interestingly enough, not very long ago, they found, even though they had not been married for 60 years, they found all of this sort of Salinger memorabilia with her, which is very interesting. She'd been sort of collecting articles and books and other materials.
We should talk about Salinger's notorious penchant for privacy. He's often considered, one of the most famous literary recluses in history. He publishes Catcher in the Rye, becomes an almost overnight celebrity, and everybody in America knows who he is. And then at the height of all of this, he disappears. In fact, isn't there a story that he literally disappeared in the middle of a dinner party?
There's a very famous, very important story that we tell in the film and the book for the first time, where after publishing The Catcher in the Rye, he's invited to this dinner party in New York, and everybody's so excited, that this mysterious, dark man is here, and you know, we interviewed a few people who were at the actual dinner, and John Leggett says, you know, Salinger was here, and everybody was very excited, and they were telling him how great he was, and he got up to make a phone call, said he'd be right back, and never returned, and disappeared into the woods of New Hampshire.
So he's right from that dinner party, he leaves New York City and disappears up into New Hampshire?
He does, and you know, one of the myths we dispel in the film is in the book is that he was a recluse. He was not a recluse, and there was nothing reclusive about J.D. Salinger. What he was extraordinarily private.
What's the difference?
There's a very big difference. I mean, think of Howard Hughes, who was a true recluse. Howard Hughes would never do any of the things that J.D. Salinger did. I mean, J.D. Salinger traveled the world. J.D. Salinger had many affairs. He had lifelong friendships. He would go to everything from the church dinner every Sunday in his community, and he would see actresses on TV and fall in love with them and write them letters and go see them. You know, he would go, I mean, can you imagine Howard Hughes showing up at a Peter DeVries play and not only watching the play, but going backstage and introducing himself to the cast?
So why does everybody think Salinger was a recluse?
Did that? Because it's a myth that has endured, and we've certainly run into it in the release of the film and the book. It's just a myth that has endured for decades that he was a recluse. The fact is he would go into New York City almost every week and have lunches. He would hang out with friends. There's just nothing reclusive about J.D. Salinger. But if you look up the word recluse, J.D. Salinger's name is the first thing that pops up. And it's an extraordinary thing. Listen, he was very good at being a recluse who, whenever the world forgot about him for a minute, popped out to remind the world that he was a recluse.
So he had kind of a complicated relationship with his own fame. On the one hand, he wanted to be left alone, a la Greta Garbo, and on the other hand, not for too long.
That's exactly right, and that's a contradiction that we have explored in the film and the book, and when we've had critics of both, they tend to say, oh, he was a recluse, he just wanted to be left alone. The fact is that, you know, it's impossible to impact the culture on the level that he did to sell a book that sold, you know, 65, 70, 80 million copies, depending on what number you believe, but the lowest number is 65 million copies, and to believe that people wouldn't be interested and want to know about his life. What he really wanted was a one-way dialogue with the world. So in 1951, when his Catcher in the Rye was picked as a Book of the Month Club, which was very important to the sales of that book, he was happy to sit down with William Maxwell and do an interview. In 1974, when he wanted to call this very beautiful reporter at the New York Times named Lacey Fosberg, he picked up the phone and called Lacey Fosberg and gave her a 30-minute interview, which, of course, a recluse would never do. When he saw Joyce Maynard on the cover of the New York Times magazine in 1972 and wanted to be with her, even though, you know, supposedly he didn't like authors' photos in any way, he set aside that rule and pursued her. So this was a deeply complex and contradictory human being, which is why he's so fascinating. You know, we were interested in making the story of his life as a man, you know, not as a god. And I think that, and that's the story we've told, you know, the real story of his life.
Why did he stop publishing?
Well, there were a number of complicated reasons that he stopped publishing, but the chief reason, which we explained for the first time, is how connected his withdrawal was and the cessation in publishing was to the Vedanta religion. When he came out of World War II with post-traumatic stress, he was deeply wounded. He was looking for something that could help him, a cure of some kind, and he turned to religion. And he tried Christianity, and he tried Buddhism, and he tried self-realization fellowship. He tried all of these different things. And ultimately, he settled on the Vedanta religion. And
which is Vedanta, what?
The Vedanta religion is a very, it's one of the most ancient religions. It's a religion and philosophy that espouses mental and physical detachment. You are not your mind. You are not your body. It teaches about renouncing both name and fame And so he actually was fulfilling. There are four tenets to the Vedanta religion, and the third is withdraw from society, which would have been 1965, and the fourth is renunciation of the world.
And that's about when he stopped publishing, right? Didn't he stop in 1965?
Yes, and that would be the fulfillment of his third tenet of the religion, withdraw from society. The fourth tenet, renunciation of the world, is very interesting. When Mr. Salinger passed away in January 2010, his family issued a statement, and the statement was, "I am in this world, but not of it." And that was the fulfillment of his fourth tenet, and that was the renunciation of the world. And so he practiced a religion that said two things: stay away from women and stay away from gold, which is really interesting given his life and how conflicted he was about that. But it also said, write for writing's sake. Don't do it seeking any reward. Don't do it for any reward outside your own personal fulfillment.
And you're saying that's what he did? Because there are allegations or there are suggestions from more than one source, I think, that he kept writing. He wrote every day.
Yes, and that is consistent with his religious beliefs, that he wrote every day, but that he didn't publish. He didn't seek ego and fame. So that's what's revealing about Salinger, was that he was, you know, we have no precedent for this in history. Can you imagine Steven Spielberg or Terrence Malick or someone like John Ford, anyone, making films for 45 years and then locking them away in a safe only to be seen after their death? There's no precedent for it in history, and that's what Salinger's done in 2013.
One of the huge revelations of your book and documentary is this suggestion that Salinger left a trove of unpublished completed work in a vault somewhere along with instructions for his publication. How certain are you of this?
Well, obviously, we wouldn't have published anything without being, you know, certain. This came after, you know, 10 years of very diligent research and an exhaustive legal vetting by Simon & Schuster and American Masters and the Weinstein Company. But these are two separate, highly credible, independent sources, never spoke to each other, never met each other, who describe the unidentical list of materials of work. And just so you know, I mean, there's no dispute that he's been writing for 40 years. He's told that to a number of people. People have seen the work in various forms. In 1972, Joyce Maynard saw two manuscripts and a genealogy of the Glass family. Other friends have seen the work. And we list all of those people on the record at the end of the book and in the film. But very tellingly, his daughter was actually led into his study for only the second time in her whole life. And he very proudly, using her words, showed her all the work and that it was marked for publication posthumously. You know, this is ready to go. This needs some editing. This, you know, and was very excited about that. And what we know is that he had said in 1961 and again in 1963 that there were many more Glass stories coming along and that it was his life's work and it gave him great happiness. Of course, he only published one more story, Haporth 16, 1924. And so we only have right now half the painting. We have half the painting that J.D. Salinger's painted for, you know, from 1940 to 1965.
So when is this stuff supposed to come out?
The work will be published in irregular installments between 2015 and 2020. And
mark your calendars.
I'm certainly going to mark mine. You know, I'm incredibly excited for this. As I said, there's no precedent for it in history. And if the work stands with his other work, J.D. Salinger is going to have a second act unlike any writer in history.
Is there going to be anything more about Holden Caulfield? Did he return to that character?
He does return to him in a very early story that he wrote called The Last and Best of the Peter Pans, which is a great Salinger title. And basically what the last 45 years has been is finishing two families, the Caulfield family and completing the entire story of the Glass family. So you have these two extraordinary families who he's going to have documented from, you know, A to Z. And you additionally have a few other books that I think are going to be very special, including a love story that tells the story of his relationship with Sylvia Welter, the Gestapo agent. And that was a fascinating relationship above and beyond the things we've discussed. I mean, they also shared telepathic communication and talked to each other in their dreams, which is something he, you know, told a number of people. And that's going to be a fascinating work. And then there's also a manual of the Vedanta religion, which is, I think, Salinger's effort to convey what has been the religious philosophy and belief system of his life to a large audience. In the book, as you know, we publish a number of letters between Salinger and his Swami, and he thanks the Swami for getting him out of his long, dark night. And he was a deep believer in the Vedanta religion, read the work every day, and meditated every day, and really found peace in the Vedanta religion, and donated a substantial amount of money to the Vedanta religion.
Well, it sounds like there's going to be enough material to fuel several PhD theses in the future. Do we have any idea, or don't you wonder if he kept going with his characters, Holden Caulfield and the Glass family, how far into the present did he take them? Because we last met them in, what, the 50s, maybe?
Well, he... You know, from the information that we have, I mean, he completes the entire history of the Glass family, and that includes all of Seymour's life. And, you know, I think the world is waiting to see the full and complete story of the Glass family.
Yeah. So I'm curious, Shane, how has the experience of making this documentary and working on this book, how has it changed the way you think about J.D. Salinger and his work? Do you feel like it's added? I mean, you started by loving his work. Do you feel like you love it more or a little less? Jerry Salinger was a complicated person, not always such a nice person.
That's a really good question. And I've struggled with this over a decade. And, you know, there's the old adage, you know, don't meet your heroes. And if you see the end of the film, there is a moment, a very special moment between the filmmakers and Mr. Salinger that I think is very important and was sort of the end of this journey. He very generously sort of gave us the ending of our film. But I have a complex answer. I think that we tried to show J.D. Salinger as a man. My love of the work deepened. My understanding of the man deepened. My feelings about Salinger changed considerably over the decade, and I had to be honest about those changes. I couldn't pretend that he didn't have this very unhealthy and inappropriate obsession with young girls. I couldn't pretend not to, because there was this unmistakable record of letters and telegrams and documents and all of the things that we had. I mean, this wasn't speculation. This was, here's the dated letter. And what was extraordinary about several of these young women or girls was that they held on to everything. I mean, Jean had the telegrams, the envelopes, the stamps, it was just no disputing that. So my opinion of him in some areas was, very difficult to process, because he was, in many ways, not a great husband, in many ways, not a good father to at least Margaret, his daughter. We tried to be very honest and tell the full story about his son, Matthew, who always maintained that he was a wonderful father, a giving father, and a loving father, and that his stories that his sister told were wrong. Everything about Salinger was complicated. Everything about Salinger had five or six layers. You could never look at the story just as a black and white story. There were always, like his work, level upon level upon level of meaning and understanding. And I'm not sure I've fully processed all of it yet, just because I'm still in it in many ways. But I would say that extraordinarily complicated and contradictory man who created, like Eugene O'Neill, this immaculate work from trauma and pain, and that it was not an easy thing to be around J.D. Salinger when he was producing this work.
So
definitely paid a price.
So I'm curious, if you could meet him today and he was uncharacteristically in a mood to answer any question, what would you ask him?
I would ask him if it was worth it. I would ask him if disappearing from the world and writing for himself only gave him the peace that I know from so many people that I spoke to he was pursuing. One of my favorite memories of Salinger is after the war, when he was really the most damaged, he was going to these nightclubs in New York and the Rubon Blue and the Blue Angel, and he was out with his friends and laughing and joking and meeting girls and telling them that he was a goalie for a Montreal soccer team. And people talk about him and they say how happy he was and that he was smiling, and I know that he was in a great deal of pain, but that's how I choose to think of Salinger, as smiling and happy. And that's why on the back of the book we have the photo of him beaming from at the liberation of Paris, because that's not the image people have of Salinger. They have this sort of dark, you know, figure, and that's not the person that Matthew Salinger and some of his closest friends talk about. They always talk about a man named Jerry. No one knew him as J.D., and they talk about a very sweet and giving man and a loyal friend. And so I tried to tell the full story of his life and the complexity of his life, and it's just a lot more complicated than guy writes a book, gets worldwide fame, and disappears. It's a lot more complicated than that, and that's why it took a 2-hour film and a 700-page book to try to tell that story. One of the nicest things that we found over the last few weeks is that, in addition to our book thankfully being you know a number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list, Salinger's Catcher in the Rye debuted again, or not debuted, but reappeared at number 7 on Amazon for the first time in, you know, forever. And so people are rediscovering the work that were old fans, and people are discovering Salinger's work for the first time. And to be part of that is really exciting. I think the message of the book and the film is that, like his work, you're not going to have a simple understanding of this man. It's going to be a very complex understanding. And like his best stories, you're going to be troubled by some of the things you read and hear about. And it's a bit like that film and book, wonderful book, A Beautiful Mind. There was genius and there is madness. And our responsibility was to tell both.
Shane, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a wonderful show.
Oh, thank you very much. And it's a great book and great documentary. And anyway, thanks for giving JD back to us. And have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.